Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real people discuss events, technology and work life in the networking industry on this September 25, 2011. This week, the virtual workbench is, well, nowhere in particular, but we're going to gather in the virtual meeting room and flap our gums just for fun. We've gathered some articles, various ideas, and we're going to flap our chins about them. Get comfortable while we get around, diagnose the problems of the network world with humor, wit, and possibly some technical talent. You'll never know what we'll find down the back of the sofa. And this week, as always, we're welcoming back the dulcet tones of Ethan Banks. What's been happening with you this week?
It is a busy month. I'm continuing my WAN upgrade, which seems like the same thing I say every week. It does drag on a bit because I don't have a minion. Anyone who wants to be my minion and is willing to work for pizza and orange soda, please send me an email and we'll talk. You come on up to New Hampshire and I'll put you to work right off. That'd be great. Thank you very much. Of course, we got Interop coming up next week, which, Amy, you're going to Interop too as well in New York City, right?
Yeah, I am. I'll be there in a week.
Oh, yeah.
Nice. And of course, those dulcet tones are those of Amy Engineer. How are you, Amy? Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm well. How are you guys?
We're doing fine. But what have you been doing this week? Which voice system have you been tackling?
Oh, this week has been a lot of system crises, a lot of help. Where'd my dial tone go? So I've been helping out users and keeping the world safe and restoring order to the universe. So.
Oh,
nice.
Oh, so
yeah, better
show.
Better you than me.
It was voice. Gosh, sorry, Dan. Sorry. I'm sure that was great.
Listeners, you'll notice this is why I end up having to host the voice shows.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Sorry. Was that my prejudice is showing? And also with us this week is Tony Burke. Tony Burke is fresh from dialoguing about Fibre Channel over Ethernet and espousing the joys of SSDs after his recent Tech Field Day 8 experience. How are you, Tony?
I'm great. Yeah, we did Tech Field Day. Was it last week or the week? Yeah, it was a week before that. Had a great time. Mm-hmm. And also yesterday I visited a nuclear reactor, and I am eagerly awaiting the superpowers, which I'm sure to start manifesting themselves at any moment now.
Mm. Wait, are you reading my thoughts? Are you reading my thoughts? can you hear them?
Welcome back, Mrs. Y, to the show this week. Now, ready to expound upon all topics security related. What have you been doing?
Well, I've been recovering from a cold this week, but it meant I wasn't in the office. Yay. And then trying to understand this new SSL vulnerability, because I spent like 24 hours just depressed. In clinical depression, you know, over the state of the industry, everything. And I didn't even want to get out of bed the next day. But so I've been reading a lot about that and trying to understand what the risks are.
Yeah, it's a beast, isn't it?
One might even say it has slayed SSL.
And finally with us this week is Tom Hollingsworth. How are you, Tom, and what's been happening in your neck of the woods?
I'm all right. This week I added a new title to my name. I am now Death, Destroyer of Solid-State Hard Drives.
Don't tell me that. I've just installed one in my MacBook, and I don't want to hear they break.
Well, I had an Intel X25, so that was their first gen solid state drive. And after 15 months, the smart settings popped up and said, "You know that funny noise your car makes when it's about to die? I'm making it right now." And so, right before the show came on, I tried to boot my laptop up, and it said, "Good luck." So Intel's getting an RMA drive first thing in the morning.
Well, I'm sure they'll be very pleased about that. They've got plenty of profits to cover that. Well, I guess we should kick on with the show. But before we do, Ethan and I just wanted to share. We've been doing a lot of work around getting some sponsorship for the show. You'll know that in previous episodes, we've asked people to make some donations and give us some help with sponsors. And many people have responded. And it's been great. And we've also spent some time reaching out to the vendors. And we just wanted to let you know that in the future, we are going to be having some sponsored shows, aren't we, Ethan?
Yes, we've been in chats with a number of different vendors that are interested in presenting their products on, and what we do when we talk to them, we kind of think about what you want to hear, what would be interesting to you. So it's sponsored, but it's not just anybody who shows up with a dollar bill can be on the show. It's something that meets what Packet Pushers wants to be able to present, in accordance with what the vendors want to present. When we have a match, we'll have them on.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing, is we're talking to the vendors about what content we want, and we want to keep it in time with the show. You know, it's got to be nerdy. As we say to the vendors, the nerd meter needs to be above 7. In the last couple of weeks, you would have seen us doing some trials. We had a sponsored podcast, a couple of sponsored podcasts from Infinetta. We've got one coming out in the next week or two with Cisco, and Cisco has booked a few different shows, and they'll be coming out over the next couple of months. We are also working with people to actually sponsor the shows, and it's good news for the show and bad news. I'm sure for the listeners, the sense is that, you know, we may be selling out, and I want to take this opportunity to invite anybody who feels that we might be to write to us and to help us stay on the path, to make it balanced, to make it reasonable, make it fair. And if you think we've gone too far, then write in and tell us what's happening. We've got a pretty good group of hosts, you know, on this show alone. There's 6 people here, and we rely on them to help Ethan and I run Pack of Pushes and keep it on the straight and narrow, and they love to tell us. And, you know, to make sure we're doing the right thing. So what we're saying is we are moving into some sponsorship. We are asking the vendors to sponsor shows to bring content to you. We are going to continue to run this show. This show will be called the Virtual Workbench, and that's where we just get engineers around to chew the fat and have some fun and tell tall stories and that type of stuff. And, you know, we're going to balance that between that with the shows that the vendors want. We are still going to reach out to people and have interesting shows about topics that interest us. But where a vendor has something that they want to bring to the audience that we might not necessarily choose, they'll basically pay for it. And that summarizes our editorial policy. So we wanted to let you know that it puts Packet Pushers on a solid footing for the future. I know that Ethan and I sort of put a lot of time into the show, and as you know, and this allows us to sort of invest time and resources into making it happen. And for you, the listeners, thank you for listening to us and putting up with us as we just rave on at you. And we are hoping to make the show better as it gets on into the futures.
So another thing we've been doing with Packet Push is we've been bringing bloggers on board, folks that have something interesting technical to say, or just talking about work life, and adding their voice to the packetpushers.net website. So when you go up to the website, you see at the top the latest audio shows, the podcast that we've been doing, and then underneath that we've got a whole string of blog posts that folks have been doing as well. And we're getting some great content. If you want to write for Packet Pushers, we're interested in talking to you. We, you know, Greg and I, and actually just about everybody on this call maintains a blog of some kind or has done a blog. It's a lot of work. It can be a little bit of a pain to maintain your own blog, and then you feel guilty because you haven't put some content out there for, you know, it was a week, and then you were feeling bad, and then it was a month, and then it's 2 months. It's like, oh, man, I haven't touched this thing for, like, 6, and you feel all guilty because you haven't been writing anything. Fine. We'd be happy to host your content. You don't have to have any guilt about not putting something new out there for a while, and join the crowd. When you blog to Packet Push, it's going to also boost your exposures. The Packet Pusher site is seeing on average now between 1 and 2,000 hits a day, just depending on what new content's been put out there. A lot of folks are subscribed to the feed, so if you want to get your voice, maybe it's a problem you're trying to solve. Maybe it's something you have to share. There's comments, there's interaction that's been happening, and it's been good. So send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know that you'd like to blog, and we'll get you set up.
Yeah, everybody's got one blog post. So even if it's just once you want to write something, you've got something you want to get off your chest. Or just recently, Josh O'Brien wrote a post asking a question. He had a problem with his network, so he wrote it up into a blog post and published it out there, and people were getting back to him with answers. You know, a good blog doesn't actually have to be, this is what I'm doing. It could be a well-written post explaining a problem and asking for people to come in and help. Everybody's got one blog post, and everybody should write. And, you know, sometimes when you first start out and you write this very first, you know, your first half a dozen blog posts, nobody notices. And it can be a little bit soul-destroying, so Packet Pushers is away. And for those of you who have a blog, and maybe you want to blog, put a few posts on Packet Pushers to point to your own blog so you get a bit of exposure, it's all welcome. It's all community, right? It's all about people sharing and making networking a better place, a better industry for everybody to share. And that is the whole purpose of Packet Pushers. So moving on to just one more free plug for Packet Pushers, if you'll bear with us.
Do we need to sing Kumbaya first?
Well, you know, That Packet Pushers is having an OpenFlow symposium. We are co-sponsoring and co-hosting an event in San Jose on the 26th of October. We have invited a range of vendors and people to come along, including Cisco, Juniper, NEC America, coming in with their programmable flow technology, Big Switch. And we've also got companies like Google and Yahoo coming to talk about their interest in OpenFlow. You've heard us talk about OpenFlow in different podcasts, so what we've done is actually set up a symposium to talk about it. It'll be streamed live in the Tech Field Day format on the Wednesday before Network Field Day. So you've got 3 days of live streaming goodness. How much fun can you have? I know Ethan and myself and Ivan Pepelniak will be moderating the panel discussions, and I know Ethan can't wait to be there.
Actually, it's going to be very cool. OpenFlow being something that everybody is really excited about. And the symposium is going to allow us to explore, well, how actually would we implement OpenFlow? Where does it fit? What do you vendors think? How are you guys approaching the different problems that are out there, and with OpenFlow being the answer? So it's going to be a good time of exploration for everybody, and then kind of solidifying in folks' minds, okay, I see what OpenFlow is and I see where it can take me. This is cool. Let's get on board and go with this.
I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, you know, hanging around with some of the biggest people in the industry is going to be great, but I'm really looking forward to the discussion and the intelligence. So we're going to stream it live, and we're also going to be recording it and dropping it into the Packet Pushers feed so you don't miss a minute of the action. I can't believe I said that.
We get questions from time to time from the listeners at packetpushers@gmail.com. One that came in this week from James Duran: how do different people go about building new skills? So we got some experienced engineers on the call here. Let's talk about James's question. How did different people go about building new skills, in particular when you're faced with a new subject, a new product, or a new technology? Where do you start? What tools do you use to keep notes? Do you do bookmarks? Is there a documentation system you've got? How do you reinforce learning, maybe build a lab and keep yourself from forgetting all of it in 3 months, which is a really good question considering all the new technology that we got out there. Hey, Tom, you want to take a stab at that?
I spend a lot of my time poring over, you know, documentation. So a lot of times when it's a new technology, you'll have good reference documentation, whether it be like an RFC or a vendor write-up or something like that. But another good thing is that and I'll use an example like VXLAN. There's not only good documentation about VXLAN, but there's also a lot of good dissection of the good and bad points. And so I like to get a good feel for how the community, you know, delves into that kind of technology and things like that. And so naturally, bookmarks are a huge part of that because, you know, like for instance, Greg's had a good post on VXLAN. Ivan has a really good post on VXLAN. So I bookmark all of those, and then I go back and I read over them 3 or 4 times to make sure I've got them.
Yeah, and I think exposure is a really important part of that too. Just exposing yourself to the new subjects in any way that you can. You're not going to retain everything in the first exposure, whether you take a class or you read a blog article. Just the way that most people learn is you build on, you expose yourself to more and more, even if it's drinking from the fire hose. Certainly not everything will stick, but after a while, things start to stick. There's a great book I once read by a guy by the name of Josh Waitzkin. I think I pronounced that right. I heard about the movie In Search of Bobby Fischer. So this is the guy that movie was based on. Josh Waitzkin was a chess prodigy, and he became a chess grandmaster by 18, and then about 19 or 20, he gave up chess entirely, got tired of the scene, and he got tired of the fame, and then he became a martial arts master. So he went from being a chess master to a martial arts master, and he's got a really lot of great insights on how to learn.
Tony, you're an instructor. Certainly that's a big part of what you do. Are there specific tools that you recommend to students that they can build a lab? I mean, maybe something more that's virtualized or running emulators to do some testing and so on?
If you're doing the Cisco world, then, you know, there's a lot of great tools like GNS3 and Dynamips where you can load up images of Cisco routers to learn.
So, Amy, you're doing a lot of study lately. What sort of things are you using to skill up on, say, this voice technology that you've recently gotten into?
Yeah, I actually do a lot of the things that have been discussed, and blog posts I absolutely adore because so many of those contain all of the gotchas that the texts often leave out things that you wouldn't know to look for. Someone went out and tried it and wrote it up, which I really appreciate about the networking community. I've also found that labbing is essential. If you don't practice it, then you just don't really understand it on the level that you need to do your job every day. So when I got into voice, one of the first things I did was I had to build a virtual machine with call manager and voicemail so that I could play with it and do it and say, okay, so these are the steps that you need to do.
What about you, Ethan? What do you do to be clever?
Well, I'm sighing, you know, in a frustrated manner because for all the stuff that I've had to learn over the years, up to and including being able to pass the routing and switching lab for CCIE Cisco, it just never ends. And so there's this process you go through of, I've learned this, I know this, I know what I need to know to get my job done, and then you kind of stop. And then you find out you never really learned something deep enough. So one of the platforms I've been working on an awful lot over this past year is the Cisco ASA firewall. Love it, hate it, whatever. I'm using it. I'm deploying an awful lot of them. And so I've made it a point to start going through a couple of different things to learn the platform really well. One, I've started with the ASDM GUI, and I've gone through in that left pane every single screen, every single expansion block, and asked myself, what does that do? What does that do? What does that do? What's it for? Then I'll head on over to the documentation and I'll read about it. A lot of it I'm never going to use. I'm not going to need it because it doesn't apply to my specific environment, but I've got some clue as to what it does. Retention's the big thing that James asked in this question. How do you keep yourself from forgetting it all in 3 months? And I think the answer to that question is I don't know that you can, in that you have to use it or you lose it. I cannot today do everything that I was able to do off the top of my head to be able to pass the CCIE lab back in April 2008. Why? Because a whole lot of things I needed to know how to do really well in that lab that I have not since done because they have not applied to the network environments that I've been in. That said, if you learn it once and then kind of forget it, the second time you learn it, man, it's a whole lot easier. And the third time, it's a little bit easier then, and so on. It comes back to you much quicker if you force yourself to go through it. There's an element of discipline here, too, that I think is implied in what a lot of us have said, what Tony has said and Amy. And you got to shut the TV off sometimes and just sit down and crank through this stuff on your own time. That's a huge element of this. It's easy to go to work for 8 hours a day and get your job done and then get in the car and come home and that's it. To be really push yourself harder is when you're doing this on your own time and you're reading, you know, after hours or outside of work time, if you will, and you're building lab stuff at home, because that's when you really have the time to get into it and go deep. Some folks I work with are like that. They got labs they're building at home. There's a friend of mine I work with. We're going to build a VMware lab because we need to get in deeper on, for me, about the virtualization stuff, and for him, the networking side of virtualization, and we're going deep. Why? Because that's what we want to do. We want to know this stuff even better. Other folks I work with, I can't wait to get out of here today. I just want to go home and do nothing. So there's a commitment you make personally to get to really, really ramp up and get strong on this.
I've sort of taken on that challenge because I work in voice right now, but I recognize that I can't afford to lose the routing and the switching knowledge. It's too valuable. So I come home and I work on MPLS labs, and it's not anything that I do all day, but it's one of those things where I want to make sure that I hold on to those skills. And like you said, you can't hold on to them unless you're using them in some way. So I try to find kind of an area that covers, you know, some of the skills I want to review, but maybe explores them in a deeper way than I maybe worked with it before. So it's still interesting. It's not just basic review. You're growing your skills, but you're not losing those basic ones you don't want to lose, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it does. I'll focus on another part of the question there, which is, what tools do you use to keep tech notes, bookmarks, and documentation? I'm going to go into a little bit of productivity porn for those of you who don't get into that. I use, for capturing documentation, I have a program called DevonThink, which is a what's generally known as an anywhere box or an anything box. And when I download stuff, I drop it into this program, DevonThink, and then I tag everything that goes into it with a little tag. So I can then, you know, so if I'm downloading something which is about OpenFlow and it's from NEC, then I'll tag it OpenFlow NEC white paper. So when I'm looking for an OpenFlow white paper, I just type in the word, I do a tag search for OpenFlow, and then I can see all the things that I've tagged OpenFlow. There's a fair bit of discipline to that. Every time you download something, you have to do something with it. Some people use a program called Evernote, which allows you to store lots of things like that. I'm not a big fan of Evernote, but, you know, everybody's got their... There's a number of different ones for the Mac platform, and they're rather splendiferous. I now have several gigabytes of PDF files and captured web pages and text files that I've scratched notes into. And this anything box captures all of those types of things. So now instead of actually just looking at a blog page on the web, I'll actually take a copy of it and snap it into my anything box as a way of holding that for later reference. So even if that blog post disappears or that vendor web page disappears, I've got that for reference later on. In terms of capturing vendor documentation, I download the PDFs. I don't read the web pages anymore. Several reasons: I often travel and I don't have access to the web. And the other thing is that reading the PDFs for the documentation can be transferred to an iPad, which can be a very comfortable way of reading stuff from time to time. Tech notes I've already alluded to, but for bookmarks, I use a program called Pinboard. It's a subscription that costs about $8 or $9 for life. It's a bookmarking site, has more features than Delicious. Or if you want a free one, use delicious.com, which is the spin-off from Yahoo. And just collect all those bookmarks that you want in your life. I don't use the Chrome or the Firefox syncing things. I use this Pinboard. And then I combine Pinboard with another web service called Instapaper. And Instapaper allows me to review these things offline. So Instapaper either has a web interface where it scrapes the web pages, but also on my iPad. So when I've got a few moments free, I can spend time on my iPad looking at web pages that I said I'd read in the next year or so. And there's like hundreds of them, of course. And that's a different way of keeping up with blog posts, so that even if you can't read. So for example, my RSS, I have an RSS reader where I capture people's blogs, which gets about 300 articles a day, which I very rapidly slim down. I can skim through them very quickly, but I still have 75 that I need to read in the next few months. And so if I can't read them in the RSS reader, I'll snap them to Instapaper for some time in the future. How do you reinforce your learning? There's no real answer for that. It's up to you to decide what direction your career takes. You might be interested in data centers, and so your voice knowledge will take a back seat. There's just no way that you can, in networking today, that you can be across everything. You can't be a data center engineer who does security as well as being a voice guy and a wireless guy. So think of, work on technologies that interest you, choose them, and then go after them, and make sure you keep pounding those into your head.
Just one point on that. I don't think everyone has the luxury of getting to pick if they want to be the, you know, the wireless guy or the data center guy. In some cases, I think there's a lot of network engineers out there that are the guy, and they have to be all of that. So I think these tools that you suggested would help them be more organized in that to do the best at handling all of those hats. If that makes sense.
Everybody's got a personal style. You have to find what works for you. I'm pretty sure that what works for me is something I've built up over the last 5 years. It might take other people time to come up with that sort of system, and you go through iterative things. You know, sit down and look at the way you're working and think about how you could be smarter about it. And if you don't know, then think about it or talk to other people about it.
Well, I think the important thing, the takeaway is, I mean, one of the ways that I found that I gain knowledge, I mean, I'm lucky at an educational institution. There are lots of different areas that you can investigate, and I'm actually one of the few generalists that you'll left in the community. But a lot of people don't take advantage of the community. They don't forge alliances. You know, if for example, we had a situation where we needed to set up a dev environment, a VM environment to test a Cisco product, but going through requesting it officially through systems would have taken too much time. So I reached out to user services. I knew they had a dev VM environment, and I said, hey, can you get us something tomorrow morning? And that's the kind of building those alliances between groups. You know, reach out to somebody who's interested in learning something you know and who can help get you access to something you want to know. You know, there are hacker spaces. And when I say hacker spaces, people always think, oh, that's security. No, hacker spaces around the country are made for the traditional use of the word hacking hardware. That means they're setting up open mesh networks. They have all kinds of cool microcontroller projects. But in going there, you will forge alliances and get with people who want to learn things, and they will help you set up a lab. You can either set it up in the hacker space, or maybe they have a home lab and they'll want your input. And then the best way to learn a new, to reinforce the skill that you're learning is to share it with somebody else.
There are three words I think that are really will help anyone in trying to learn, and they're very terrifying words, especially in our general industry, which is, I don't know. Just admitting you don't know something is very tough for a lot of technical people, because that's our currency. Our currency is our knowledge, and to admit we don't know something is kind of like, you know, exposing your throat in the wild. And also conversely, creating an environment where other people are comfortable with saying, I don't know. Everyone's going to learn much quicker that way. I used to work in an environment where we had one really good tech guy, but he would mercilessly rip into someone for saying, I don't know, and just ridicule them and so forth. And it really stunted everyone's growth.
I don't know how you can know everything. You can't know everything today. It's almost, I tend to disbelieve the people that come off thinking like they know everything. We should all be past that at this point. There's just way too much to know, and it's new just about every week. Something significant new is coming out every week.
Yeah, it's hard. And for what I do, in a lot of ways, you know, I'll have a priority list in my head of, okay, I need to know about this. How much do I need to go into it? Okay, not that much. I'll keep it in my Dropbox, you know, little organized folder of stuff. Then, and I'll go back to it when I need it. But I have a high level enough of a view so that I can feel comfortable in a conversation or talking about it. And then admitting, okay, I don't have a deep dive on this, you know, so you're going to have to go slow.
That sounds about right to me. I mean, there's no one answer here. One thing to think of is that networking has changed a lot in the last 2 years compared to the previous 10. For example, in 2002, we had OSPF and BGP and RIP as the routing protocols, and today we have BGP, OSPF, OER, you know, and MPLS is versions of it. We have multicast, which is now a serious routing protocol and getting more serious with every single day. The industry has going through a very huge period of change. Don't let that daunt you. Don't look at the whole thing and say, I've got to eat the whole salami at once. Just slice it off and say, I'm going to start by learning this piece, and then do that for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and then go to the next piece and then do that. Don't try and take over. Gosh, we are all sounding a bit serious. So let's move on to talking about something a little bit more lighthearted. It is, of course, this week that Hewlett-Packard replaced their CEO, Leo Apotheker, who has done a stunning job of not doing what he's supposed to be doing in a CEO role and causing all sorts of problems at Hewlett-Packard, has been ousted and replaced with the former eBay CEO, Meg Whitman. Two things to think about. One is that Apotheker seemed to have set HP on the road to becoming more of a software company, which is obviously in the face of HP, which has always been a hardware company. And secondly, that Meg Whitman, when she left eBay, was leaving because she wasn't that very good at what she did. And yet, now all of a sudden, she seems to have been lauded for how fantastic she was. She did leave eBay for a reason, and that was because she wasn't the right person to run a big company. And now she's been set up as the person to run a big company, which I find deeply amusing. But there you go. Well,
that's
that
the
just
way it works,
me?
Isn't it? Isn't it the Peter principle? I mean, you rise to the level of your incompetence. We actually have a saying at work. Oh, they took something down. They're going to get promoted.
Well, I look at this and say that this is a decision of the board at HP, and they're looking at this mostly from a financial perspective. So they must think Meg Whitman is bringing something to the table as CEO where she can lead HP to turn more profits over than the guys that have come before, although it's been a bit of a revolving door there. So I wish her luck.
No, that's not the case at all. She's not going to lead HP anywhere except into the ground. Meg Whitman's the CEO because she'll do what the board tells her. Notice that the three biggest mistakes that Leo Apotheker supposedly made, killing WebOS, the purchase of Autonomy, and the spinoff of PSG, those three things are still going forward. there was never a reversal of the decision. They just canned Leo because of the way he handled the flare-up from it. They're killing him because his stock price went down. Meg was on the board, and according to all reports that were coming out, there was one that said nobody really ever talked to Leo before they hired him because the board's too busy fighting with itself. There's more infighting going on the board than there are decisions being made. So they put somebody in charge that will do what they're told in an attempt to get the stock price back up to prevent the rest of the board from being fired during the next election cycle.
What direction does HP need to go to get the profit to come up? I mean, they're
get
killing
rid of the board. No, really. Well, there was an article that came out, and I think Greg linked to it in one of his weekly link posts. They've been nominated for being the worst board in the history of corporations. They're right up there with Yahoo. But, I mean, they have made – what are they on now? Between Leo Apotheker and Mark Hurd and Carly Fiorina, they have made three horrible decisions one after the other. And now they're going to do Meg Whitman. So we're on hopefully not to four, but, you know.
The main thing from my point of view is that Hewlett-Packard was in the networking industry on an absolute tear. They bought the 3Con. Mm-hmm. They took 2 years to assimilate it and to productize it. They've got had a go. They had a damn fine chance. But anybody who was considering about re-strategizing their networking kit away from their existing vendor, usually Cisco, and looking at HP would now be going, oh, I wonder if they're going to close that. You know, would you really seriously consider? And that's undermining HP's position in the marketplace. And I think that's a sad thing because HP is a good company and does have great potential. And to see it run into the ground like this is a disappointment.
Well, you notice they've kind of gone dark. They aren't saying anything right now, especially the networking crew. Because I mean, by the time in Interop Vegas, they were all over the place. They were making, you know, statements and things like that, and now you don't hear anything out of them. I think the problem is that HP is – they're an aircraft carrier without a captain.
Okay.
I was going to say, I think they're – oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I just wanted to make the point that the one of the reasons that I read about that they got out of the PC business is it's very difficult to make money in that. It's a very low-margin business, and so they finally said – fine, forget about it. We're done with this. We're going to get out. That was one of the arguments. I think on the networking side, you can make huge profits selling switches and routers and these sorts of things. So I think, yeah, the question's a natural one. Okay, they're getting out of the PC business. There's a lot of shuffling going around. Are they going to say, well, they don't have enough market penetration to make the kind of money we want to make on HP networking, so we're going to kill it? That could come up. At the same time, I think there's a lot more points for them to work with just getting hardware and software out the door. So
can you make him get out of the software business, please?
Not going to happen.
Oh, man, I can't stand that HP software. It's horrible. Just, yeah. We use their product management suite. It's horrible. Their project management suite. It's awful.
Then their software tends to reflect the limitations of their internal organization, which is a very polite way of saying that internally HP is several fiefdoms and they don't work across each other. Some of it's brilliant, of course. But it's a bit patchy.
If they stand any chance of pulling this out, they're going to have to come out with a clear vision. And just like with Cisco that's fumbling a little, you know, they're going to have to come up with a vision that people can get behind. And the fact that they're being really quiet, it just makes people more uncomfortable. People don't like the silence. It's more uncomfortable than them coming out and just saying something that maybe people don't agree with or they do agree with. The silence is people are making – they're making things up in the absence of them coming out with – a direction, a strategy, and that's potentially just more destructive than anything else they could do.
There's another article this week in computerworld.com about IT systems being run in a shed. Basically, the article makes the point that if you put your IT without air conditioning, it runs just toot sweet and doesn't really need all of the magical goodness that we have in a data center. And I'm pretty sure, Ethan, we talked about this in a previous show about building data centers, building low-cost data centers and turning the temperature up. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that you could run your data center at 27 or 28 degrees without causing any loss.
Yeah, and that was a big point of this article. He was saying that you don't have to have a data center that runs at super low temperatures. You don't have to have a data center that runs as a clean room, if you will. And because the electronic components can hold up to it today. And when you're trying to do a data center that is power and cooling conscious, where you're not you're trying to reduce your power consumption by designing your data center well, by installing components that use less power and generate less heat. And if you can run them a little bit warmer, you're going to save yourself a whole bunch of power there. And that's so he takes all of these systems, throws them out in the shed. He took, the article mentions that he takes sawdust and chucks it into the shed that he's running all this equipment in, just to make the point of, yeah, dirt, dust, whatever, they can take it. Wow. Systems can take it. Now, I just as kind of a personal example, I did a little work on the side for a small radio station in the area that ran their station off of a PC, sitting in a kind of a dirty, nasty room that was leased to them very cheaply. It was not air-conditioned. And the temperature was stifling. If you walked up into that, you know, when I'd go up there to do a little bit of work on the system for them, it would be uncomfortable. You'd be sweating in no time flat, easily into the 90s and 100 degrees during the heat of the summer. That system ran for 8 years. We're just now going to replace it because they're doing some other work on the radio station. That system ran for 8 years, 24 hours a day, running that radio station, and it just worked. And that was PC-grade material. That was not server-grade material like you'd put up in a data center. Quite something.
I mean, a lot of our stuff runs in suboptimal temperatures and environments. We have hub sites. I think I told the laundry room story that the it clogs the condenser of the air conditioner, and then the air conditioner goes offline, and then the switches heat up. We've had switches melt, but then there have been plenty of times where, you know, they're not in the best situation, and they seem to do fine.
Let's face it. That we design systems to break, too. So if you lose the odd switch or the odd server, I mean, it really shouldn't matter, should it?
I think it comes down to the design of the equipment that you're putting into the extreme environment. Because, you know, we have servers that can run at 110 degrees Fahrenheit for a certain period of time without completely destroying themselves. But I've also had... and this is a PC, so it may be a bad example, but I've seen those small design PCs, the small form factor ones about the size of a toaster, that were running in a room that was just room temperature. They were running longer than they were supposed to have, and it melted the plastic clips that hold the processor down onto the board, which I've never seen anything do that. So,
cool.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I touched the outside of the case, which was brushed aluminum. And, well, I could go into a life of crime now because I'm missing several fingerprints because of it. But you have to get a manufacturer who understands those kinds of things. You don't want to get, like, you know, white box server manufacturers that don't leave enough airflow through their cases or something like that. I think this is the article brings up a really good point that, yes, you can run these things in extreme environments, but you can also drive a Ferrari on a dirt road because it's a well-designed car.
Good point. No, I mean, and the other thing is, I guess you made some really great points. I mean, just because you can, does that mean you should? I mean, I think that's the direction we're going. You hear stories about what Google is doing in terms of cooling and power and exploring all these different options, vertical wind turbines and stuff like that. But, you know, are we there yet? And do, you know, does a small enterprise want to be the shop that explores this, or do you want to wait for the big guys to do it? And then you go, okay, well, they're doing it.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, two things. One is the point I already made, which is we design systems to fail. Why don't you expect them to fail from time to time? And the cost of the failure is probably cheaper than the cost of the air conditioning. For every degree that you try and cool, the system has to work exponentially harder. So to bring the temperature down, so if the outside temperature is 45 degrees, then to bring to bring it down to 20 degrees, you've got to work X. Bring it down to 19 degrees, you've actually got to work at X plus 30%. Just that 1 degree makes all the difference. You could run...
But we're not preventing failure here. What we're avoiding is the paperwork after the failure.
Well, there's a lot to be said for that. Yeah. It's hard to have a grown-up discussion around failure at the moment with all of the Prince and ITIL people and the MBAs, because failure doesn't happen, does it?
Oh.
Failure is not acceptable.
Five nines,
yeah. Failure is not acceptable. Whereas, in fact, in IT, failure is acceptable. It's to be expected and embraced, and you should expect it to happen. It's only a matter of time until failure happens, and you've got to train for resiliency. So we build these systems to be redundant. We have redundant air conditioning. We have redundant power. We have redundant servers. We have redundant applications. We have load balancers. We have. So why don't you just accept the fact that failures are going to happen and get over it? Anyway, Moving right along, this week Cisco announced support for Hyper-V in terms of their Nexus 1000. So those of you who've been following VMware, Cisco's Nexus 1000 is a software switch that replaces the vSwitch in VMware. And this week Cisco has announced with Microsoft that Hyper-V will soon have a version of the Nexus 1000 replacing the virtual switching capability in their Hyper-V product. Tony, you're our resident data center overlord.com. Tell us, what do you think of that?
Yeah, it's interesting. The I think you were the one who mentioned that the love affair between Cisco and VMware is now over. I mean, they still, of course, work together very closely, but they're no longer Cisco, especially with the UCS product, and the Nexus 1000V is no longer rah-rah VMware. They are hedging their bets. They're spreading the love in terms of what they're supporting. They've also done a bunch of, I think, white papers with Hyper-V and the Cisco UCS platform. So it's they're diversifying. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. I just kind of wish it wasn't Microsoft. A little part of me throws up in my mouth every time I hear Hyper-V. And it has nothing to do with the technology. It is just my old aversion to all things Microsoft. You know, I started as a Linux and Solaris administrator, and I've been, you know, resisting Microsoft for the past 10 years. That's kind of hard to get rid of.
Yeah, pull your trousers up. Your prejudices are showing.
What about you? I think Cisco's just following the market here. I mean, after the VTax licensing issue with RAM in VMware 5, I mean, I think everybody put the brakes on their VMware deployments and said, whoa, wait a minute here. Let's think about this. And so now Cisco's going, maybe we need to have another horse in this race just in case.
Yeah, and they were doing it kind of before that as well. They were, when UCS came out, it was all VMware all the time, which made sense. Yeah, all VMware EMC, they did a lot with NetApp as well. But it was it made sense because VMware had, what, 80, 90% of the market. But then started going into desktop virtualization and Citrix owns desktop virtualization. So they are hedging their bets and going in many different ways.
They're building themselves into a platform. So where before, my view would be is that Cisco was once, we do VMware with EMC and Cisco networking and Cisco servers. Now it's, we are a platform. So Cisco supports connectivity to NetApp and to EMC and to all the storage players. And we support all the hypervisors on our UCS and our networking equipment. Cisco is a platform, not a niche, not a vertical. They announced their product, attached themselves to a vertical, partnered with the strongest players in the space, VMware and EMC, which is ultimately one company. Remember that EMC owns VMware to the tune of 80% of it. And what's also interesting to note is that EMC is now out loud and proud about saying, we own VMware. Which is an interesting, it's no longer what EMC is verticalizing their product while Cisco's broadening the appeal. What about you, Mrs. Y? You got a view, or do you just not care about Microsoft like everybody else?
I don't know. I read this great blog post today about that virtualization is, with all the beefy hardware we have, that virtualization is like riding riding lawnmower. And they're talking about, this guy had some interesting perspective. He said it was under NDA, but he said it looks like the future is building, getting rid of the OS and building the hypervisor and app, the hypervisor into the CPU, and just not having to deal with OSs or anything anymore. So this may be, in a year, we may be looking at hardware solutions completely, and all of this may just change. It was a really good blog post. I put it on Google Plus and on Twitter. But because it makes sense.
Yep, that's the Hoff, sometimes known as Beaker, and he is a cloud security expert. And the blog post is Flying Cars and Why the Hypervisor is a Ride on Lawnmower in Comparison. What he's basically, as you said, the software features which are hypervisor today will be moved into the CPU. We're already seeing that with the hyper extensions that Intel's put in, and they're going to continue to put more in. And eventually it'll just be a CPU function for a server. It was so obvious I just never thought to write about it, really. I'll put a link in the show notes about that. The other thing, just going back to Tony's point about Microsoft and aversion to them, they will get it right eventually. It might take them another year, or it might take them another 5 years, and they'll eventually ship something that will actually be acceptable. And because it's on those MSDN CDs, people will find a way to use it.
Believe what I choose to believe.
Hi, it's Greg here. The show went on for so long that Ethan and I decided that we should cut it into pieces. So we're going to cut it here and call that a wrap. As always, you can contact us via the website at packetpushers.net, send us email at packetpushers@gmail.com, or follow us on the Twitter as @packetpushers. We love to hear your feedback about today's show. And more importantly, we'd appreciate you joining in with some of the activities we're doing, like the Applied Open Flow Symposium, or if you want to do some blogging, get in contact with us, and we'd love to set you up with an account so you can write something to share with the community. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.